And welcome back to Coast, science advisor, head of the Enterprise Mission.com, Richard C. Hoagland with us next. Couple hours to talk with Richard about all kinds of things going on in space, including one of his questions: what if John F. Kennedy had survived? More with Richard next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Richard C. Hoagland. Richard, of course, you know all about him. Author of Monuments of Mars, Dark Mission as well, heads up the EnterpriseMission.com as our science advisor. So much going on these days, Richard. Comet Ison right around the corner, probably by the corner by now. How are you?
Hello there, George. It's been a long time no see.
By the way, happy Thanksgiving to you and Robin, and I hope you have a great day.
Yes, and happy Thanksgiving to you and to our Coast family, and we have a lot to be thankful for.
Is Mr. Hoagland, does he do the cooking, or does Robin?
Mr. Hoagland shares cooking with Dr. Robin, yes.
Who is the best cook?
You've got to be kidding. You really want to get me killed just before Thanksgiving?
It's her. There's no doubt it's her. Hey, by the way, I understand she's got her own radio show going.
Yes, she does. In fact, she's got two of them. She's got her Wednesday regular 3-hour afternoon show, which she did this afternoon. And then every morning she does 2 hours on the Revolution radio network, like drive time news and features and interviews and very timely things. And so she's getting up at the crack of dawn now. It's a really grueling schedule, and I'm fascinated to see how she's holding up.
Yeah. She's sent me a few messages every once in a while, and she seems to love it, Richard.
You should be a guest.
I would do that. Absolutely.
You could just stay up.
We'll work it out. That's right. Is it easier for me to do the show if I'm in L.A. or in St. Louis?
Well, let's see. It's her morning show is on Mountain Time because I have to shift time zones here. It's from 8 to 10 Mountain, which would be what? 7 to 9.
And I get off the air here at 4 in the morning.
Yeah, so if you were in St. Louis, it would be easier to just stay up for an hour or so and
okay.
Have coffee and all that.
All right, we'll work on that. We'll do it after Christmas. How about that?
Great idea.
Okay, anyway, what's going on? By the way, I do want to talk with you about your what if, because that was a fascinating question.
Let's save that for the end, because that's a very complicated story, and I don't want to...
It sure is. It's a lot of speculation.
I'm lifting freely from Jeff Greenfield's amazing book, but the thing he didn't cover in his book is Kennedy's huge contribution to history, which nobody seems to get except me, I guess, which is space, which is, sending us to the moon. So I want to save that for the end. I want to start with Ison, and then we'll segue to Mars, and then we'll probably save the last hour to do Kennedy justice.
Got a deal. Yeah, I do want to get your reaction, by the way, to the picture you've seen, the iguana on Mars. And if you look at the picture of a real iguana on good old planet Earth and compare it to that, looks like the same thing that somebody put a lot of gook over. What is it?
The only problem is there's been a series of these images. There was remember the hamster? And then there was a dinosaur.
And the rodent? Or is that the same one you're talking about?
And now there's the iguana. I'm incredibly suspicious, George, because as you're going to see when we go to the section of images that Lex has been really breaking his back tonight on getting ready to put up on the site, there are some stunning real things that don't belong on Mars. And if you can't hide the real things, how do you get people to kind of just put it all in the junk bin and say it's just nonsense? You have to put out fake stuff, fake rodents, fake iguanas, fake dinosaurs. So I really see this as a very sophisticated, image-altering, political disinformation campaign to get people to not look at the real stuff we found, which is not rodents and reptiles, but mechanical, ancient, fossilized junk, which has been eroded now by millions of years of the Mars climate going from deposition to erosion, and which we found in almost every Curiosity image. And there are now tens and tens of thousands. has some piece of junk sticking out of a rock or a crevice or lying on the surface somewhere that is not being officially commented upon, because I think we're building toward, and I hate this word, but, you know, I guess Bassett coined it, so we'll use it, disclosure. And as I said to Art when I was talking at great length with him about this, and he jumped up and down about the last image we're going to show tonight, there seems to be a careful political cover your backside by NASA, which is, you know, designed to remove them from the chain of indictment when the you-know-what hits the rotating kitchen receptacle, and this all comes out. They have to have a record, a legal record, that they have been putting out real things and not hiding or censoring. And the way they do that is they've been putting out these amazing images with all kinds of artificial things just all over the landscape, if you know that, if you kind of expect that it's there. But if you're not expecting it's there, if you're operating under the paradigm that this is impossible, that all us crazies who say this is going on are just off the edge of the paper, then unless there is an official press conference at some official government level, either NASA or above, and I think it's going to be above, no one who even notices this stuff and jumps up and down is going to be taken seriously. But what they've done is they've carefully prepared a sidetracking diversionary program by jumping in a few of these obviously stupid and ridiculous anomalies so they can discredit any of us out here as just seeing things. Now, how can I say all that? Because they've officially said it themselves. Back when Curiosity first landed, which was the 6th of August of last year.
Right, and it's still going strong.
Over a year and a half prior to tonight. John Greensfeld, who was the project scientist, was asked at one of the first press conferences what they were going to do with photographs or images, because they're images now, they're not photos, that showed evidence of biology on Mars. Now, the questioner was thinking in terms of microorganisms, things like stromatolites, which are big clumpy colonies of, you know, millions of microorganisms. You can find them living on the beaches of Australia. Even now, they're ancient. They've been on this planet as early life forms for literally, you know, half a billion years, if not longer. Well, Grunfeld said that our policy will be, and I'm going to paraphrase now because I don't have the words right in front of me, but he said, our policy will be to put everything out. And if there are people, meaning not people on the team, but people like us, who jump up and down and see things, we will not be stampeded. We will do the appropriate, careful, methodical, scientific investigation and then make a timely disclosure if there is science. So they basically gave us the game plan. And they've done it brilliantly. I've got to say they've done it brilliantly, because when the day finally comes when it has to be admitted what there is on Mars, the remains of this incredible global planetary ancient high-tech civilization, that Curiosity is returning thousands of images of this mangled junk they're from, they can claim with absolute honesty, we didn't hold back, we put the images out. If you were too damn dumb to notice them or recognize them, it's not our fault.
Richard, you've supplied us a bunch of images, which I've been looking at all night long. And I want to go through each one individually and have you, of course, at the helm.
Yeah, let me get on the same page here.
And let's get everybody up to their computers. Richard has supplied us with a number of images, and you got to look at them, because they are truly unbelievable, especially with the way he has interpreted some of these. And
okay, now are you saying unbelievable in a good way or a bad way?
In a strange way, which could be a good way, a coast way.
So we should start by them going to the coast homepage.
Click on the images.
Click on the images at the top.
And the first one that comes up is the Comet Ison trajectory.
Yeah, this is the NASA trajectory of Comet Ison, a very nice piece of art that I thought kind of encapsulated what's happening. This thing was discovered last September by a couple of Russians using International Astronomical Network of Telescopes called Ison. That's where the name Ison comes from. It's not the name of one of the Russians' girlfriends. It's actually the name of the telescope network they used to find this thing. And it's been falling in toward the sun ever since, getting brighter and brighter. Did not live up to early expectations about brightness, but in the last 24 hours, it's so incredibly amazing that if we, and I haven't actually had time because Keith is the Keith, Lex just sent me a email telling me that he had put a link at the very bottom of the page. Yes, there it is, okay?
Yeah, he's got it.
If you go way down to the very bottom of the image page, you'll see it says, for more, check out this daylight image of Ison. This is an amateur astronomer in Slovakia who a few hours ago, still on the 27th, was able to photograph Ison getting close to the sun in daylight. And if you click on that link, it will take you to a Facebook page which shows the actual image. The black thing in the upper left is an occulting device to obviously screen the brilliant sun from the camera, you know. And the little tiny dot, white dot, in a gray sky, apropos of your last guest, between two black lines, is the actual comet, now bright enough to be visible in the daytime sky. So in the next few hours, and this thing is going to round the sun at closest approach at 1:44 Eastern Standard Time for U.S. audiences. That's 18:44 Greenwich Time. So make your appropriate time zone corrections. At 1:44, it will be closest to the sun, literally less than one solar diameter away from the seethingly brilliant, much too bright solar surface. You do not want to look at the sun. You do not want to use binoculars. You don't want to use any kind of optical aid because you can literally burn your eyes out and you won't feel any pain because the optic nerve doesn't have a senses so you can feel that you're searing your eyeballs. So the best way, if you want to be brave and try to see this thing, is to go outside around noon when the sun is highest overhead where you are and hide the sun behind a building.
Good point.
Preferably a building, you know, several hundred feet away so that you can really kind of adjust yourself to be in the shade. And then look alongside the sun on the left-hand side at around noonish your time. And you could see something because this thing, in the last few hours, I was monitoring the international chatter and traffic of the ISON, you know, observing network, which is a global network of amateurs and professionals that are exchanging emails via the web and Yahoo groups and all that, and, you know, twittering back and forth about their observations and magnitudes and brightnesses and cometary emissions of gases and dust and all that. It's a kind of a running, mind stream of information on what this thing is doing. And it was brightening so dramatically just a few hours ago that there were folks that were actually looking to see it in New Zealand, just the way I described, hiding the sun behind a tall building so you can kind of stand in the shadow and try to look alongside the sun. Do not use binoculars or a telescope to try to look at it, and be very, very careful that you do not step out of the shadow so you look directly at the sun for more than a second or two, because you can do permanent damage and you won't even know it because the eye does not register pain.
I have told Dr. Sky that I think this comet is going to disintegrate. What do you think?
I think you're wrong, George. I think it's going to become incredibly spectacular because it's been behaving so bizarrely, following nobody's model. And we've been looking at the, shall we say, abnormalities regarding its orbit. I have a feeling this is going to really, really surprise us in the next few days after it passes perihelion and comes out the other side and we can see it in the dawn skies again. And it could, on Christmas Day, be such a significant celestial object that it could literally become a stand-in for that classical celestial object that I used to talk about when I was back at the Hayden Planetarium and the Springfield Museum of Science, the so-called Christmas star. It
yep.
could literally become brilliant enough to attract a lot of attention by people who normally never get a chance to see anything interesting in the sky.
That's amazing. Well, like, you know, like Halley's Comet that comes around every 76 years. What about this one? Is this a one-time event? Or
it's a one-time event. It's, you see it now or you'll never see it again. This thing came in on a trajectory which is literally hyperbolic, meaning it's not captured by the sun. It fell in from maybe halfway between us and the nearest star from what's called the Oort cloud, which is the model, you know, where these Berge bits hang out in basically circular or very, very gentle elliptical orbits. And the mainstream model is that a passing star millions of years ago perturbed this thing gravitationally enough that it lost some energy and it began its long fall in from that incredibly cold outer darkness to where millions of years later it can whip around the sun just above the photosphere and leave like a very, you know, sharply bent hairpin, never to return again. The problem is that it's been, if you look at the trajectory, which I and some of my colleagues have been doing, it isn't behaving like a natural object should behave.
No, it's, I agree with you.
That gets us into really strange territory.
I agree with you there.
And there are folks who will jump on this and raise all kinds of fear porn, which they've been doing over and over, all over the web. I mean, this is even worse than Elenine.
Well, but I don't hear you doing that.
Because that's not what I think is going on. You remember, you and I have discussed for years and years and years the possibility, backed up by real evidence, that there is a secret space program, which is separate and parallel to the NASA program or the ESA program or the Russian space program or the Japanese or the Chinese, a space program that does not use rockets, that does not use the primitive, you know, Newton's third law reaction devices that we've been using for decades to send astronauts just into the low Earth orbit. And, you know, 47 years ago or more, sent astronauts to the surface of the moon and brought them home. That there is another technology to which we are not privy. Now, the guy you need to have on to talk at length about this is Dr. Paul LaViolette.
I've heard of him.
Yeah, you've never talked to him?
We may have had him on years ago.
Oh, yeah, you got to have him on now because he wrote an incredible book that I've been reading and rereading and rereading, which is basically the inside classified story of how the U.S. government has developed bona fide anti-gravitational space propulsion technology and programs built around it and used it to build ships. And he's got all the paperwork, all the documentation, all the studies going back to a brilliant genius named T. Townsend Brown in the 1920s, who was a protege of a scientist called Byfield, who worked with Albert Einstein. And because of what Brown discovered in the way of the electrical control of gravity, called electrogravitics, there is absolute evidentiary evidence, if I can be redundant, that this kind of technology exists, and we just don't know about it because they, the proverbial they, have worked very hard for the last 50 years plus to keep us from knowing.
Well, let's find out when we come back, Richard, what you think they have done. Richard Hoagland with us. And again, go to our website, coasttocoastam.com. Look at the images he supplied. After we get done talking about Comet Ison, we're going to get into some things on Mars. And, of course, our guest tonight, Richard C. Hoagland. Much more to talk with him about, but get up to the website and track us as we talk about some of those images. If you're driving, well, we'll just try to paint a little picture for you. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast with Richard C. Hoagland. So, Richard, are you saying that ISON could be one of ours, a craft?
What I'm saying is it's not beyond technical or political feasibility that somebody using the technology of the secret space program has maneuvered this thing into this precise orbit for symbolic and ritual and celebratory purposes, kind of like a foreshadowing of pretty amazing events to be announced down here on planet Earth, a kind of a celestial opening act. Let me read you a couple things from LaViolette's book. This came out in 2008 when I was invited, literally the week I was invited to address the Libertarian National Political Convention in Denver, where I gave a presentation based in part on the secret space program, and I drew heavily upon the Amazon preview that I had of Paul's book. The exact title, people should write this down, except if you're in a car, please don't do that. Secrets of Anti-Gravity Propulsion, Tesla, UFOs, and Classified Aerospace Technology, which raises this book to the level of real research and scholarship, is his incredible, phenomenal footnoting with actual documents, both released and leaked, which he peppers this very, very large book with. Let me just read you some of the table of contents, because the chapter titles tell you why you should really pay attention to the idea that there is a secret space program. It is official. They've hidden it from us for decades and decades, and it has the capability to do everything I'm going to talk about in the next few minutes.
And I am marveling over the third item that you sent us.
The one with the crop circle comparison?
Yeah, that is weird.
Isn't that special?
Yeah, it really is.
Okay, just Paul's chapter headings. Anti-gravity, from dream to reality. Beyond rocket propulsion. Onward and upward. An etheric explanation. The U.S. Anti-Gravity Squadron. Gravity Beam Propulsion. Project SkyVault. I bet you didn't know we had an official Air Force program to investigate anti-gravity spacecraft called Project SkyVault, did you?
No, sir. I did not.
Microwave phase conjugation. Unconventional flying objects. The Searle effect. You've heard of John Searle, I presume.
Yep, sure have.
Electrogravitic wave experiments. High voltage electrogravitic experiments. Black hole discovered in NASA. That's an incredibly interesting chapter about all the political chicanery the agency has gone through to keep this technology secret. And finally, a technology that could change the world. And that's going to be our segue into the Kennedy thing. Given that as a basis, and you got to read the book to know this is real stuff, it's not science fiction, it's not made up, it's real, then maneuvering a chunk of ice into a cometary orbit that would splash celestial fireworks across the skies to punctuate a terrestrial political agenda centered around, and this is going to surprise a lot of people, or maybe not, President Barack Obama, would not be beyond the capabilities of this technology at all. It would be trivial. It would be, you know, one finger exercise. It would be duck soup, to use another cliche. The political effect on Earth, however, could be shattering to a paradigm which is that we're all there is. It could, in fact, be used to create a false flag alien presence.
We've heard this before, haven't
we? Not. This is why Paul has done a stunningly important work and a contribution to the nation and to freedom by laying out that this is a technology which has been kept from us, up to and including the possibility, George, it was actually incorporated in the Apollo lunar module to successfully effect the landing and the takeoff from the moon, something that I've been pursuing quietly for 10 years. And, I mean, there is no end to the implications if you can document and validate the presence of this kind of research. And LaViolette has done exactly that.
I have a friend who is an executive with Boeing based in St. Louis, and he's part of the defense unit. And I asked him a couple months ago, Richard, specifically, I said, are you working on a anti-gravity craft of some type? And he said, George, don't ask me that.
Interesting.
Again. This is a friend. And he said, just please don't ask me. I said, are you saying you have it? Uh-huh. He said, I'm telling you, I'm not talking to you about
that's
this.
That's a plausible deniability answer.
Yep, sure was.
Sure well, was. I Boeing investigated defense. Along with Ken Johnston and Robin. We drove to California to look into a technology developed by a guy named Cook that actually got Boeing to test his technology. And the Boeing report was that it exhibited remarkable anti-gravity properties. It had nothing to do with the electrogravitic approach of Townsend Brown and many of the other people that are in LaViolette's book. This was a mechanical rotating system, which works on very different principles. Bruce De Palma, my dear departed friend Bruce De Palma, from whom I have freely, you know, stolen and modified his Accutron torsion field detection technology, mm-hmm. he developed a series of mechanical rotating systems that exhibited stunning anti-gravity properties that are not electrical, meaning that you actually rotate physical masses and you process them at a certain frequency and you wind up, you basically can kind of, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps by hooking on to the ether, the yep. torsion field, and negating the equivalent action-reaction of Sir Isaac Newton. So there are a number of different ways that are in the literature that are being experimentally confirmed to do this thing. It's, again, that we live in a culture where there is mainstream science, and they point fingers at all the rest of us and say, those guys are nuts. And because they have the money and the power and the networks and the National Science Foundation and NASA and the entire political establishment, everybody except a tiny handful of us crazies believe them and don't believe what's right under their very eyes, which is why LaViolette's book, again, you know, Paul has a PhD in general systems science. He's a PhD, you know, he has a doctorate in basically what I do, which is being a generalist. And he has pulled together an amazing array of information and documentation and actual papers that prove the case overwhelmingly that this stuff exists. So if it exists, then what would you use it for? Well, you'd use it for whatever the folks at the top of the policy keep want to use it for, up to and maybe including creating a incredible light show at the end of 2013 to affect some political developments that are going to manifest down here on Earth in the not-too-distant future.
This is one of the greatest stories I've heard from you in a long time. Unbelievable.
Well, now you know where I've been for the last few months.
It's just, it's crazy. We, by the way, we did have Paul on about 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah. Oh, you got to have him on.
But it's time
to have him on in the next few weeks because
we'll work on that for you.
He is ready, willing, and able. He's got the goods. He's done his homework, and he's the right guy. And what's really interesting is a few weeks ago, I started getting emails from, I can't tell you who, I can tell you what. It was an official archivist at a major university that is part of the, and I'm going to make up a term here because it's not the actual technical term, it's part of a stringer system for the National Archives. Did you ever wonder, George, how the National Archives gets the stuff that it puts in the archives?
Yeah, I have. Quite
well, they basically have stringers. They have historians at universities all over the country.
They have ears everywhere.
And eyes and ears, and they basically have them keeping on the lookout for important stuff that needs to be, you know, preserved for the national historical, you know, archive system. And so they have a flotilla of individual folks scattered around the country that are basically their grassroots eyes and ears. Well, one of those people saw something come across his desk that he knew because he was working with a couple of grad students that actually apparently really love my work and love the Enterprise Mission website. And they flagged it to him as being important. And he, in turn, sent me an email and asked me, would you kind of be interested in this? And what it turned out to be were a set of letters between T. Townsend Brown, who is the chief scientist who basically created the American anti-gravity program, and Lawrence Bell. Now, Lawrence Bell is a name, no relation to Art. Lawrence Bell was the founder of the Bell Helicopter Company in Buffalo, New York. The Bell Helicopter Company, through some bizarre chain of events that I've never been able to really understand and I've been looking at from afar with a kind of a jaundiced eye, for some reason got the contract from Grumman, who had the contract from NASA to build the lunar module, the spaceship that Neil and Buzz and the other guys flew to and from the moon in. Grumman gave Bell Helicopter Company, a helicopter company, the contract to produce the engine for the ascent stage of the lunar module. Now, what the heck did Bell Helicopters know about building rocket engines? Well, it turns out that in this correspondence that this archivist let me in on, the conversation between Townsend Brown and Lawrence Bell was all about how to create anti-gravity technology.
Well, so let me propose this to you.
Oh, there's more to the story, though.
How would you like, though, when we get Paul to come on, and I'll call it even with you on our little bet?
Oh, you mean me hosting Coast?
Yeah.
I'll host Coast. Come on.
And I'll be there to do my...
I want to host Coast by myself.
Well, I got to do the commercials and stuff.
Well, so? That's
part and parcel. I'll be there.
I'll certainly come on and be your science advisor when you talk to Paul. But no, our bet stands separate. I'm not.
You want your own little show, huh?
I want my own... I don't want a little show. I want a big show. And I've been waiting carefully until the political timing is right. And we're coming up on it, George.
I haven't forgotten the bet. And let's tell people what the bet was, because they're probably saying, what the heck are they talking about?
Okay.
I made you a bet before before Barack Obama was elected in...
when he was at 20% in the polls.
20%. I said...
I bet you, and then you accepted it.
Yep,
he was going to be the next president of the United States.
And I said Hillary was going to get the nomination, that you were nuts.
Yeah, I was totally out of my mind. And the terms were, I said, if I win, I want to host Coast.
And what did we say if I won, which I didn't?
You said I wouldn't be on Coast for a year.
I would never do that.
And I looked at you and I thought, this is the dumbest thing I've ever heard George say. And there were like a dozen TV cameras and 1,000 people in the auditorium.
Everything was being videotaped.
And there was this gasp. Well, I basically won. And it wasn't luck.
You did.
I actually
did,
had psyched out why Obama had to be the guy. Well, Comet Ison appears to be kind of complementing my research in that there's all kinds of numbers attached to Ison that come up 44 again and again and again and again. I'll give you one example. On Christmas Day, if you're standing in downtown Honolulu, remember, there's a big controversy over where was the president born,
right,
Honolulu or Kenya, right?
That's almost like people have forgotten that.
Yeah, well, we're reminding them.
You know,
if he was born August, I think the 4th, 1961 is the date. The controversy is, was it Honolulu or was it Kenya? Well, if you are standing on Christmas Day, which is, 3 weeks from now, in downtown Honolulu at 4:40 a.m. in the morning, 4:40 is 44, right?
All right.
Ison will appear at 44 degrees azimuth from true north.
There you are in those degrees.
Well, the thing is, you can't make these numbers up. Celestial mechanics, of all the things NASA does, the one thing they can't lie to us about, as I said to
Henry
at Red Ice a few weeks ago, is the celestial mechanics. Because amateurs all over the world are pointing their go-to telescopes at these coordinates to look for these things. And if they lied about where this thing is going to appear, there'd be a million people that would catch them lying. So you can't hide the sky. You can't lie about the sky. So this thing is on a trajectory that on Christmas morning at 4:40 a.m., it's at 44 degrees from due north. Oh, and at 17 degrees plus altitude, meaning elevation above the horizon, and 17 is part of the larger Obama myth that I don't have time to get into tonight. The point is, this is not the only time this occurs. A few minutes ago, remember I talked about the perihelion time when Isan is supposed to pass closest to the sun?
Mm-hmm.
Remember what the time that was in Washington time?
No.
1:44 p.m. tomorrow afternoon. Well, actually this afternoon, because we're already on the 28th.
We're already on the 28th.
Okay, you can begin to do a probability calculation, and I'm only touching the tip of the iceberg here. There is no doubt in my mind or my colleagues' mind, like people like Greg Ahrens, who lives in Missouri. You know, he's from Missouri. He doesn't trust anything. He's done the numbers independently of me. We've come to the same conclusion. There are many other colleagues that I'm working on with this, and we all are of the opinion that you cannot make these numbers up. This trajectory is manufactured to hit these marks for ritual purposes, which, remember, Mike Barra and I covered extensively in Dark Mission, but there's a huge ritual side to NASA that no one ever sees, having to do with landings and takeoffs and missions to various places according to celestial alignments and key ritual stars and constellations in the ancient Egyptian mythos. That mythos appears to have been transferred by some technology to Isan's trajectory, and in out total, you know, antidote to all the fear porn around this object, my take is that they're setting us up for some major paradigm shifting announcement where they want the beneficence of the gods, if you can think of it that way, because they're dealing with an ancient religion that they believe in. They just don't happen to tell us that that's what they really believe.
Will that announcement come soon?
I have no idea. In the next year, there are things going to happen celestially involving Mars and another comet called Siding Spring, just about a year from now, that is going to be even more phantasmagorical. And I'm waiting to specifically discuss it until we get some more data. But this could well be the lead-in, the run-up to that, which, if you can imagine, could be even more earth-shaking and spectacular and would have all kinds of implications that you don't want to jump the gun and basically talk about until you have the data that give you the certainty that you're dealing with real stuff. I can talk about ISON because the numbers are overwhelmingly there. I cannot talk about Siding Springs in the same way yet.
I want to, Richard, when we come back, go through some of these Mars artifacts that you've got some images are, and then we'll talk about that question you emailed me a few weeks ago, and that was, what if Kennedy lived? What would happen with the space program today? Where would we be? That's a curious question. We'll get your take on that as well. Richard's website, of course, enterprisemission.com. You can also like him on Facebook. He's got a lot of followers there. So go ahead and you can get to the Facebook link through his enterprisemission.com site as well. And we will be back in a moment. If you need to email me, that's george@coasttocoastam.com. And at our website, you too can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. And as you know, we now have Instagram going on as well. So we'll be right back. More with Richard C. Hoagland on Coast to Coast AM.